electrical generating capacity of the United States was 600,000 megawatts. So if we take the higher figure, we are talking about increasing the U.S. electrical output by nearly one-seventh. This would be clean hydroelectric power, no pollution, no CO2, no acid rain. The cost would be stupendous, but perhaps not much greater than the $300 billion the Pentagon has managed to dispose of annually since 1984. Physically, such a solution appears within the realm of possibility. In a $6 trillion economy, it may even be affordable, disregarding the question of whether it makes economic sense. In the West, many of the irrigation farmers who are threatened by one catastrophe or another regard it as a matter of life or death, and it has long been an obsession to no small number of engineers and hard-hat politicians. Its main drawbacks are that it would largely destroy what is left of the natural West, and it might require taking Canada by force. Larger than California and Oregon and Washington stitched together, flooded by up to 200 inches of rain annually, bisected by big rivers whose names few people know, British Columbia is to water what Russia is to land. Within its boundaries are, in whole or in part, the third, the fourth, the seventh, the eighth, and the 19th largest rivers in North America. It is debatable how much of the world's accessible and renewable fresh water the province holds, but the usual estimates are between 4% and 10%. The Fraser River alone gathers nearly twice the runoff of California. The Skeena's flow approaches the runoff of Texas. Both run to sea, all but unused. The Talchaco River, the main branch of the Bella Coola, which empties into the Pacific halfway between Vancouver and Prince Rupert, is fed by ice fields the size of eastern counties, and in the early summer the river runs like the Mistral, a riverine expressway in a Yosemite canyon that would make a dam builder gasp. Among the larger rivers of British Columbia, it barely rates a passing mention. The relative proximity of so much water to so much arid land has been a source of compulsive longing in the American West for years. It wasn't until the late 1950s, however, that anyone began thinking seriously about moving some of that water south. It is undoubtedly the grandest scheme ever concocted by man, and it was conceived, rightfully enough, in an engineering office in Los Angeles. Nahuapa, like the mouth of the Amazon River or Itaipu Dam, it is a thing one has to see to comprehend. And since it hasn't been built, even its architects may undervalue its brutal magnificence. Visualize, then, a series of towering dams in the deep river canyons of British Columbia, dams that are 800, 1,500, even 1,700 feet high. Visualize reservoirs backing up behind them for hundreds of miles, reservoirs among which Lake Mead would be merely regulation size. Visualize the flow of the Susitna River, the Copper, the Tanana, and the Upper Yukon running in reverse, pushed through the St. Elias Mountains by million-horsepower pumps, then dumped into nature's second-largest natural reservoir, the Rocky Mountain Trench. Humbled only by the Great Rift Valley of Africa, the trench would serve as the continent's hydrologic switching yard, storing 400 million acre-feet of water in a reservoir 500 miles long. The Upper Columbia and Fraser, which flow in opposite directions in the Rocky Mountain Trench, would disappear under it. Some of the water would travel east, down the Peace River, which would be remade and renamed the Canadian Great Lakes Waterway, all the way to the Great Lakes and the Mississippi. It would be enough to raise the level of all five lakes, double the power production at Niagara Falls and down the St. Lawrence, New York, after all, has a large congressional delegation, and allow some spillover into the Illinois River and the Mississippi, permitting ocean freighters to reach St. Louis and providing a fresher drinking supply for the cities now withdrawing carcinogenic wastes from the river. The rest of the water would go south. Imagine the sawtooth lifts, a battery of airplane hangar siphons shooting 30,000 cubic feet per second through tunnels in the Sawtooth Range of Idaho and on to California, Nevada, Arizona, and Mexico. Imagine Lake Nevada. Imagine the Columbia-Fraser interchange by which the West's two largest rivers would be merged, a Pecos River reservoir the size of Connecticut, the feckless Pecos, having received a huge jolt of water from the north. Another giant reservoir in Arizona, which through some probably unintended irony would be called Lake Geneva. Imagine 19 million acre-feet of new irrigation water for Saskatchewan and Alberta. Imagine 2.3 million acre-feet for Idaho, 11.7 million acre-feet for the Texas High Plains, 4.6 million for Montana, 13.9 million for California. Under the NAWAPA plan, water would, as usual, flow uphill toward political power and money. Imagine the Mojave Desert green. Imagine, on the other end of the continent, a phalanx of hydroelectric dams across the bigger rivers pouring into James Bay, the lower appendage of Hudson's Bay. Actually, those dams are the one part of the NAWAPA plan one needn't imagine. Over the past 15 years, at a cost of $16 billion, Canada has gone ahead and built the James Bay project itself. NAWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, was conceived in the early 1950s by Donald McCord Baker, a planning engineer for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Baker took the idea to Ralph M. Parsons, the head of the Pasadena-based firm bearing his name, who instantly fell in love with it, as he would later insist, everyone who has worked on it has fallen in love with it. Before his death, Parsons created the NAWAPA Foundation, a tax-exempt receptacle for surplus profits from his company, which had fed on dams and aqueducts until it became the third or fourth largest engineering firm in the world, and dedicated it to enlightening the ignorant and converting the unappreciative about the project that was to become the obsession of his twilight years. In the 1960s, when anything big and brutish got at least a passing nod of attention, the NAWAPA scheme excited a considerable spasm of interest. Stuart Udall was able to declare, as Interior Secretary, "I'm for this kind of thinking." Some exploratory discussions were apparently held between Canada and Secretary of State Dean Rusk. Groups of dignitaries began making excursions into Canada under the auspices of the NAWAPA Foundation and the Wenatchee Washington Daily World, whose publisher Wilfred Woods was as enchanted by NAWAPA as Parsons. In the 1970s, however, as the environmental movement and Canadian nationalism waxed, NAWAPA's fortunes waned. Udall, having become a conservationist in office, began ridiculing the idea. Even the Bureau of Reclamation, which had been secretly assisting the NAWAPA lobby, along with the Corps of Engineers, began to hold it at arm's length. In April of 1965, Commissioner Floyd Dominey went so far as to deliver a mild reprimand to an overenthusiastic Bureau engineer who had spoken too loudly and fondly of NAWAPA. "While I agree that potential interregional water transportation is a subject in which the Bureau is intensely interested and with which I hope the future will find us closely identified," Dominey wrote his subordinate, whose name was Lewis Smith, "I do not believe the time is ripe for us. We should, however, be prepared to move quickly should we have the opportunity." But the idea was kept alive by diehard believers. Former Utah Democratic Senator Frank Moss, who in 1985 was still being kept on retainer by the Parsons Company as a NAWAPA lobbyist, Hawaii Senator Hiram Fong, the late Governor Tom McCall of Oregon, proving that one could be a conservationist and a NAWAPA booster too. "This is a plan that will not roll over and die," Moss lectured anyone who would listen. "It may be 50 years or it may be 100 years, but something like it will be built." By the late 1970s, Frank Moss was beginning to feel vindicated. People were gunning each other down in gas lines. California had just come through the worst drought in its history by a gnat's eyelash. Nuclear power seemed on the verge of collapse. The Islamic Revolution was the latest threat to America's imported oil. Thousands of lakes and whole forests were dying from acid rain, a consequence of sulfur and nitrogen emissions from fossil fuel power plants. Suddenly, the monster project that had been all but given up for dead began to twitch again. In October of 1980, at a California conference on a high-technology policy for U.S. reindustrialization, sponsored by the Fusion Energy Foundation, an offshoot of the U.S. Labor Party, which despises the Soviet Union but envies its inveterate commitment to gargantuan public works, Dr. Nathan W. Snyder of the Parsons Company reintroduced Nawapa to a large and enthusiastic audience. Ultimately, the decision to build Nawapa or a project similar to it will determine in some part the future economic well-being in North America, said Snyder. Water is the most basic of all resources. Civilizations grew or withered depending on its availability. The Canadians, for their part, have viewed all of this with a mixture of horror, amusement, and avarice. Few seem to believe that Nawapa will ever be built, but anyone important who mentions it on either side of the border usually rates several column inches in the Vancouver Sun. A number of times in the past several years, Canadian television crews have trooped into the United States to film the sputtering irrigation pumps in West Texas, the salt-encrusted lands in the San Joaquin Valley, and the ghostly abandoned orchards in central Arizona. In western Canada, at least, paranoia about Nawapa seems to be the reigning state of mind. A few years ago, a British Columbia television journalist named Richard Bocking wrote a blistering book entitled Canada's Water, For Sale?, which attacked not only Nawapa, but the huge and, as far as Bocking is concerned, pointless dams and reservoirs being built and planned by the provincial utility BC Hydro. Reservoirs that, as Bocking pointedly noted, could serve someday as off-the-shelf storage basins for a water exportation scheme. The more conspiratorially minded in Canada's environmental community are convinced that an intimate confederacy exists among water developers, a kind of Freemasonry of engineers, which makes them willing, even eager, to aid one another's grandiose ambitions at the expense of their own nation's interests. It happens to be true that in Canada, most of those favorably disposed toward Nawapa belong to the water development fraternity. A Canadian professor of hydrologic engineering, Roy Tinney, has even proposed a somewhat less stupefying version of the plan, nicknamed CNOP, that would divert the Peace and Athabasca rivers and some of the water in Great Slave Lake to southern Alberta and the American High Plains. Every now and then, a British Columbia politician has dropped a coy hint that his province, which is, politically speaking, far more independent of Ottawa than an American state is of Washington, might be open to some mutually profitable continental water scheme someday. Moira Farrow, a reporter for the Vancouver Sun, who has covered water policy for years, says that some of the province's leading political figures are privately awed by the Nawapa plan, as if they wished they had thought of it themselves. There is, in fact, a great deal in the plan for Canada, as there is for Mexico, which has a surplus of oil, but a chronic and grim and worsening shortage of food. Canada would get more hydroelectric power than the United States, some 38 million kilowatts under one version of the plan. Mexico would get 20 million acre-feet of water, enough to triple its irrigated acreage. Canada would also get a great deal of irrigation water, and if the contemplated navigation canals are built, a shipping route between its mineral-rich northland and the Mississippi and Great Lakes. It is Canada, however, that would have to suffer the worst of the environmental consequences, and they would be phenomenal. Luna Leopold, a professor of hydrology at the University of California at Berkeley, says of Nawapa, "The environmental damage that would be caused by that damn thing can't even be described. It could cause as much harm as all of the dam building we have done in 100 years. Every significant river between Anchorage and Vancouver would be dammed for power or water or both. The Tanana, the Yukon, the Copper, the Taku, the Skeena, the Stikine, the Liard, the Bella Coola, the Dean, the Chilcotin, and the Fraser. All of these have prolific salmon fisheries, which would be largely, if not wholly, destroyed. Since the extirpation of around 90% of the Columbia salmon run, the Fraser, the Stikine, and the Skeena have become the most important salmon rivers on Earth. In the western United States, the plan would drown or dry up just about any section of wild river still left, the Flathead, the Big Hole, the Selway, the Salmon, the Middle Fork of the Salmon, the Yellowstone, the Madison, the Lochsa, and the Clearwater would largely disappear. In Canada and the U.S. alike, not just rivers, but an astounding amount of wilderness and wildlife habitat would be put underwater, tens of millions of acres of it. Surface aqueducts and siphons, not to say 100-mile reservoirs, would cut off migratory routes. Hundreds of thousands of people would have to be relocated. Prince George, British Columbia, population 150,000, would vanish from the face of the earth. In general, though, the project's proponents display a peculiar blindness to the horrifying dislocation and natural destruction it would cause. They are far more comfortable talking about how Nawapa is our only hope of averting worldwide famine. Because of its unprecedented destructiveness, and due to a natural reluctance on the part of Canadians to let go of so much water for the sake of their paternalistic and overambitious neighbors, the tours organized by the Wenatchee Daily World in the 1960s encountered pickets at every airstrip in the bush carrying signs that read, "Water thieves, beware." By 1981, anti-Nawapa sentiment in British Columbia had, if anything, intensified. Everyone seemed to have heard of it, and nearly everyone was against it. Nearly, because here and there one finds someone who is for it, at least for some smaller version of it. Declining emphatically to be identified, a fairly well-known professor at a major university said, "The thing is too big and destructive as is, but a smaller version is worth considering. Compared to the damage the loggers are inflicting on the coast, a few big new reservoirs and canals might appear harmless. The water is worth a lot of money to us, potentially. We wouldn't have to go out and fell whole forests for income. Besides that, I think Canadians are being very narrow-minded about the whole thing. We depend on you for food, and why shouldn't we help our neighbor when she's running out of water if we have far more than we can ever use?" The logging of which the professor spoke is by far the largest source of income in the province of British Columbia, and is being conducted with a careless abandon that might make even the U.S. Forest Service wince. Logging is also a cyclical industry, expanding and contracting in rhythm with such imponderable forces as U.S. deficits and housing starts. Agriculture is more stable, and water could be sold through 40-year contracts like those of the Bureau of Reclamation, ensuring a steady, predictable income every year. Derek Sewell, who teaches at the University of Victoria and is widely acknowledged as the foremost authority in water in Canada, says that Canada has its own water shortages looming, particularly in the Okanagan region of southern British Columbia, western Canada's fruit basket, and on irrigated parts of the Alberta Plains, where the farmers are overdrafting groundwater as determinedly as their American counterparts. For the foreseeable future, he sees no possibility of Nawapas being built unless Canada itself broaches the idea. "There's a xenophobic dirigiste mood in this country today," Sewell says. "Canadians feel like a colony of the U.S., which is in a certain sense justified. You own 95% of our oil industry, for example. So the mood is against exporting our most vital natural resource. But eventually, Canada will approach the United States and say, 'You want some of our water? Okay, here's the price to be paid. We'll deal with you in realistic terms. Water will be part of an overall program of resource development and production. You want our water? Then don't build a garrison diversion project or keep the return flows out of Lake Winnipeg. We'll give you a certain amount of water for each certain percent reduction in acid rain.' Canadians will eventually come to realize that as far as the U.S. is concerned, water has a value far beyond that which prevails today. You could almost say that we've got you over a tub." So what, all things considered, are the odds that Nawapa will be built? "We're going to solve the water problem through conservation," says one venerable U.S. hydrologic engineer. "We're not going to build any Nawapa projects, even if the Canadians invite us in. The Bureau of Reclamation is going to have to start charging realistic rates for water, and the farmers are going to live with them by saving a lot of water. We're going to solve the energy problem with coal. I don't know what we're going to do about salinity, put it off into the future probably. I don't know if we're even going to build any more big water projects in this country. The economics went sour 40 years ago. A lot of irrigated land will go out of production and we'll just watch it go out. Nawapa is the kind of thing you think about when you're smoking pot, says another. People who say it will be built are crazy. Ralph Parsons himself told me he wasn't really serious about it. He just needed the foundation as a tax dodge. We won't build the big Nawapa, says a third. But I bet we'll build the baby Nawapa. No one knows how much money water will be worth in the future, but it's going to be worth a lot. When we see we're about to lose millions of acres of the most productive farmland in the country, and thousands of towns are going to go bust, it will just be a tremendous shock. If we stop talking about water importation for a while, the Canadians will bring it up themselves. Recently, the Soviet Union decided, after many years of planning, to shelve a scheme that would divert the Ob River, three-quarters the size of the Mississippi, from its northerly course into the Arctic Sea and send it 1,500 miles or so deep into the steppes of Central Asia. A second diversion, which would shunt the Sukhona River into the Volga, has not yet been shelved, but remains in doubt. Together, the two projects are about as ambitious as a Nawapa scheme built to 2/5 scale. As a result of the decision, the Aral Sea will continue to decline indefinitely at its current rate of 11.5 feet per year due to irrigation withdrawals. Central Asia will simply have to get along with more rational use of its own resources, said a group of Soviet water planners in an official statement. Then they added, at least until the 21st century. On April 21, 1981, the Premier of British Columbia, Bill Bennett, on a tour of California, gave a speech at San Francisco's Commonwealth Club. Castigating those who wanted to stop building dams, Bennett told his audience that a way must be found to harness and preserve the fresh water pouring out of British Columbia to the ocean. Dams are more than hydro, he explained. They preserve our greatest resource and control wild runoff. A questioner then asked whether, since British Columbia at the moment had no plans to use the water Bennett wanted to conserve for anything other than hydroelectric power, his call for more dams meant that his government was considering the exportation of water to the United States. The answer was no, Bennett said firmly. Then he added, but come and see me in 20 years. Shortly after Bennett's speech, Canada was smacked particularly hard by the worldwide recession that followed in the wake of the Reagan economic policy. In British Columbia, the timber industry went moribund, and plans for several huge hydroelectric dams on the Peace, Liard, and Stikine rivers were indefinitely shelved. The provincial utility, BC Hydro, cut its staff force from 11,000 to 6,000, and unemployment went into double digits throughout the country. As a severely chastened Canada began crawling, slowly and unsteadily, out of the deepest economic morass it had seen since the Depression, one could detect a strikingly different attitude on the part of some of its prominent politicians toward a Nawapa-style water diversion scheme. Early in 1985, the leader of Quebec's Liberal Party, Robert Bourassa, began to push an eastern Canadian version of Nawapa, the Grand Canal, for a great replenishment and northern development canal concept, which would turn James Bay into a freshwater lake by constructing a tremendous dike across its northern side. The big rivers feeding the bay would pool below the dike, forming a freshwater reservoir nearly the size of Lake Ontario. The water would then be led by aqueduct into the Great Lakes, and from there, according to engineers from the Bechtel Corporation, which was spending $1 million to study the plan, to the American High Plains. The estimated cost would be $100 billion. On the whole, I find more interest in the idea than opposition, said Robert Bourassa. I view the prospect with enthusiasm, said Brian Mulroney, Canada's new prime minister. Meanwhile, the people of northern Quebec, mainly Cree Indians, are seeing their culture disintegrate under the waters of monstrous reservoirs being erected by the $35 billion James Bay hydroelectric project, which is selling power, though not yet water, to the United States. I don't think the people of the province would stand for it, said Frank Miller, the premier of neighboring Ontario. Afterward to the revised edition. In 1978, the year I moved to San Francisco to begin writing this book, the fifth horseman of the apocalypse rode off into a bowl of heat and dust, and the sixth flashed in on a flood. The previous water year, which in California runs from October to the following September, had been the driest since record-keeping began. Water year 1976 had been the third driest. But late in 1977, the skies miraculously opened, and water year 1978 ended up as one of the wettest on record. It was a first act. By February of 1979, spillways were roaring at dams whose reservoirs had almost gone dry 2 years before. In 1980, the third year in a row categorized as very wet, the jet stream, carrying storms like aircraft in a landing pattern at O'Hare, took aim at Southern California, and for weeks, the Los Angeles River was so swollen with runoff, there was talk of building an aqueduct to send it north. Then came the really big water years, the El Niño winters of 1982 and 1983. No one fully understands why the ocean warms during El Niño episodes. Vast climatic oscillations are involved, and you can't safely predict the result. But strong El Niños tend to coincide with heavy precipitation years. The early 80s El Niño was the sharpest warming on record. The first huge storm hit the California coast just after Christmas in 1982. Winds over Mount Tamalpais, north of the Golden Gate Bridge, blew 110 miles an hour, and after a truck tumbled onto its side, the bridge itself was closed for only the second time since it was built. The thousands of gouges, slumps, and landslide tracks that you see in the hills surrounding San Francisco Bay were mostly caused by that storm, which dumped more rain in an hour than parts of California ordinarily see in a year. During the following winter, superstorms such as this were routine. In the Sierra Nevada, the standing snowfall record of 750 inches, set in 1906, was eclipsed by 15 feet. Yosemite Valley was underwater. The storms, bloated with subtropical moisture that seemed to be flash evaporating from the ocean, were not wrung out, as they usually are, by the Sierra Cascade blockade. Mirages in Nevada and Utah filled with real water. The Great Salt Lake flooded highways miles from its fleeing shore. The Colorado River, at spring melt, was unofficially gauged at 350,000 cubic feet per second. That was the flood that damaged the spillway directly under Glen Canyon Dam, and, by washing in millions of cubic yards of silt, hastened Lake Powell's ongoing metamorphosis from reservoir to farmland. The El Niño episode played itself out by 1985, and the weather returned to normal for a year or two, until, on Valentine's Day in 1986, just as this book first went to press, one of the three biggest California storms since the turn of the century decided to make landfall. I was in a Santa Monica hotel room when the frontal system approached the coast. I awakened to a radio weatherman in mid-sentence, saying something about an electronic buoy a few dozen miles offshore that was sending in low-pressure readings such as you measure inside the eye of a hurricane. I scrapped my plans and decided to flee for home. The ocean below my window was all whitecaps and tremendous gunmetal gray swells. Ocean Avenue was already a litter of palm fronds torn off the trees by flailing winds. My flight was one of the last to leave before the LAX tower radioed pilots to reroute or wait out the worst of it. 40 tons of flying machine felt like a hummingbird in a gale. A flight attendant tumbled across 3 rows of passengers when the aircraft fell down an elevator shaft. As we landed in San Francisco in horizontal sheets of rain, screams and prayers turned to tears of relief. A few of us went straight to an airport bar and at 2 in the afternoon got stone drunk. The storm series lasted almost without interruption for 10 days, lending credibility to Noah's flood. Central and Northern California, where most of the big reservoirs are, were the hardest hit. I had always had a mordant wish to watch a dam collapse, and this seemed like the best opportunity I might get in my life. I arrived at Oroville Dam just as the storm was beginning to break up. It took me hours longer than usual to get there because shallow lakes had formed across Interstate 680, creating instant new refuges for mallards and pintails. In the previous week and a half, the Feather River watershed at 5,000 feet had unofficially recorded 55 inches of precipitation, most of it as rain, which melted several feet of snow lying on the ground. Tampa gets that much rain in an average year. The spillway at Oroville is a big concrete channel that loops around the right abutment of the immense earthen dam. It was dumping 150,000 cubic feet of water per second, a couple of rivers the size of the Tennessee. That much water in that confined a space, the spillway's about as wide as a basketball court, is in a hurry-up mood. My guess is that it was moving 30 or 40 miles per hour. Small trees and shrubs lining the spillway fence were bent double under the force of vortex winds created by so much mass in a rush. A crow, sailing arrogantly a few feet overhead, suddenly executed some frantic maneuvers to avoid being sucked in himself. He, too, had never seen anything like this before. Where the spillway poured the river back into the river below the dam, it didn't so much pour in as fly in. A dense plume of mist mushroomed 80 stories high, split by three arching rainbows. A dam did actually burst during the flood, though I didn't see it happen. It was a temporary cofferdam built at the prospective site of Auburn Dam, whose construction had been mired in lawsuits and debate for years. The cofferdam held back about 100,000 acre-feet of water, 32 billion gallons, that merged almost instantaneously, with a river already swollen to 10 times its normal size. The flood on a flood headed into Folsom Lake, which sits 20 miles above Sacramento and has a capacity of about 1 million acre-feet. Folsom Dam would have to spill the whole reservoir, 320 billion gallons of water, in 3 or 4 days in order to absorb the mythic flood pouring in. If it did not, the dam itself would be jeopardized, and if Folsom ended up like Teton Dam, then a lot of Sacramento would float under the Golden Gate Bridge. When I arrived, a whole crowd of disaster buffs was already there, held at bay by dozens of highway patrol. I managed to sneak briefly onto the dam crest anyway. It trembled as a bank might tremble during a hurricane. The spillway at Folsom, a concrete and rock dam, was built into its center. It's really a man-made 200-foot waterfall. At the time, it was dumping much more water than Niagara Falls. You couldn't have heard a jet taking off 500 feet away. That's the kind of noise 1 million pounds of water makes, 1 million pounds a second, as it tumbles a couple of 100 feet and crashes into a canyon riverbed. If Folsom was going to be destroyed, it would probably be a consequence of the falling river chewing out the bedrock on which the dam was built. The waterfall reversed direction about 80 yards downriver and rose up in a towering, backfalling hydraulic wave that raced back and crashed into the dam's downstream face as if it wanted a second chance to knock it to smithereens. Rapids with big reversal waves are the kind that kayakers fear most, because you can be trapped forever in the churning backwash. In a reversal of such monstrous size, a kayaker would have had the free will of a toothpick. A group of boaters was standing near me, screaming at one another over the river's roar. They were debating how long it would take before a trapped boater was ground down to individual molecules. The Department of Water Resources later estimated that 10 million acre-feet of runoff, enough for the city of San Francisco for 40 years, had poured out the Golden Gate in 2 weeks. The crew of a freighter miles out to sea that was plowing through huge waves off the gate said the wash coming across the bow tasted almost like Evian. Californians didn't know it yet, but they were riding a meteorological roller coaster, and the Great 86 storm was the crest before the giant drop. During all but one of the five subsequent water years, the annual runoff of all the rivers emptying into San Francisco Bay was less than the runoff measured from February 14th to February 28th in 1986. By 1992, nearly all of the state had suffered through six dry or critically dry years in a row. The fiercest drought since the Dust Bowl, when California had 7 million people instead of the 31 million who officially live there today. Unlike the drought of the mid-70s, which held the state in a vice grip for a couple of years and suddenly let go, this drought was like a lobster headed for the pot. It clamped down savagely, held on relentlessly, and then really began to squeeze. By 1990, one of Santa Barbara's two water supply reservoirs was a plain of sun-cracked mud. The other, bigger one, was about a quarter full. A few years earlier, therapists in Southern California reported that they were seeing lots of people showing clinical signs of depression because the sun had disappeared for weeks. Now, some of the same people were spray-painting their lawns green and hiring Indian rain dancers to try to coax in a cloud. Santa Barbara, a pretty city situated on a sliver of plain between hulking mountains and the sea, used to cherish its geographic isolation and its minimal water supply because both help to constrain growth, which most people there abhor. It is the one major city in Southern California that decided not to hook into the state water project. By 1991, however, panicked Santa Barbarans had voted to build a spur to the California aqueduct through ranges of mountains at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, and to construct one of the world's largest desalination plants, which will cost them many millions more. Had it not been for a series of storms that came on shore in March, when the rainy season is usually about to end, the 1991 water year would have been the driest in California history. Until those storms arrived, precipitation in some parts of the state was less than 20% of normal, and measured runoff was as low as 5% of normal. Even when it did rain, hardly any runoff made it into the reservoirs. The famished landscape soaked it all up. 1992, the year in which I am now writing, has been much the same. December and January, which are usually the wettest months, were numbingly dry, but toward the close of the rainy season, for 2 or 3 weeks, southern and central California were battered by storms. Not much of the runoff could be captured, because from Monterey south, California has few reservoirs of real size. It doesn't rain enough in the south to make building them worthwhile, and when it does rain, it often rains violently, so the rivers carry great volumes of sediment and debris. A small reservoir built on Malibu Creek in the 1920s had utterly silted up by the mid-1940s. Meanwhile, Northern California, where the real reservoirs are, was again bypassed by the biggest storms, and so as I write this, the state is entering the dry season and its sixth consecutive year of drought, with less than half its usual water supply on tap. As it happened, the drought was just a backdrop against which a patently California Sturm und Drang was being acted out. In 1989, Northern California was hit by an earthquake that, though not exactly colossal, it released about 3% as much energy as the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, killed dozens of people, and caused $7 billion worth of damage to homes, buildings, and public infrastructure. 2 years later, an enormous wildfire swept the Oakland Hills, destroying 2,500 homes, taking more lives, and inflicting at least $2 billion worth of damage. Only a few weeks afterward, on Interstate 5, the worst mass highway collision in U.S. history occurred, involving 151 cars. About a year later, a pair of walloping earthquakes jolted the Mojave Desert, which has become suburban Los Angeles. In the midst of this litany was a hard winter freeze that wiped out a $1.5 billion citrus crop and yet another earthquake, which reduced much of the lovely town of Ferndale, far up on the north coast, to rubble. Joan Didion once described the state as an amphitheater of natural disaster, and all these events bore her out. Life in California was imitating a heavy metal cartoon. Only none of these was a natural disaster in any true sense. Earthquakes are quite harmless until you decide to put millions of people and $2 trillion in real estate atop secure fault zones. California is not Brazil, and it is far north of Florida. Orchard growers are always gambling with frost. The mass collision, a macabre excitement on the world's most boring stretch of interstate, was caused by a huge cloud of dust blowing off a cotton field that had been plowed bare and then fallowed due to the drought. Everything about California that is contrived and man-made, and therefore vulnerable, came together for the Oakland Hills fire. It began with a match, or a cigarette dropped in a field of Turkish grass gone to straw. The native bunch grasses, which can tolerate drought, have been all but usurped by invasive varieties. The grass fire spread into a grove of Australian eucalyptus trees, which can stand a drought, but not a hard freeze. The resin-rich eucalyptus, which burned fiercely when frost-killed, went off like Roman candles, showering embers from roof to wood-shingle roof. The drought itself, which may end up a more costly disaster than all of these combined, qualifies best as punishment meted out to an impudent culture by an indignant god. But the worst damage, ecological and economic, could have been averted, even after 6 dry years, had it not been for acts of man precipitated by the usual combination of willfulness and avarice. It wasn't a man-made drought, but man made it very much worse. Before the gold rush, the streams that drain into the Central Valley from the Sierra Nevada and the northern coast range represented so many miles of salmon-spawning habitat that you could have stitched it all together and run it across the continent and back again. By the 1960s, 97% of it was gone. Friant Dam single-handedly wiped out a spawning run of 150,000 fish by blocking and dewatering the entire San Joaquin River. Salmon could live with the small hydroelectric dams built high in the mountains decades ago. They cannot live with giant, impassable multipurpose dams built low in the foothills, whose main purpose is usually to capture as much water as possible that can then be taken out of the rivers. Despite the worst disruption of salmon habitat that you can find anywhere on Earth, the Sacramento River and a few tributaries in the late 1960s still supported a surprisingly robust salmon fishery, the most productive south of the Columbia. There were 4 distinct subspecies: a fall run reared mainly in hatcheries that was the bread and butter of the commercial salmon fleet, a distinct late fall run, a large winter run, and a rapidly declining spring run, a superfish that goes over 40 pounds and blasts through Class 5 rapids on its way to spawning reaches nearly a mile above sea level in the Sierra Nevada. The Sacramento River is unique in the world for its 4 runs of Chinook salmon. In good years, after the war, the Sacramento fishery could sustain a harvest of several hundred thousand fish, and in great years, a million or more fish. The tenacity of the Sacramento River salmon was remarkable because of the deadly obstacle course the fish, juveniles and adults, have to run from the beginning to the end of their lives. Shasta Dam blocked off enormously productive spawning beds in the watershed. Other dams on important tributaries, especially the Yuba and the American, did the same. The Red Bluff Diversion Dam, at the gateway to the last mainstem spawning reach, frustrates many thousands of upriver migrating adults despite a fish ladder that goes around it. The intake at the Glen Colusa Irrigation District, capable of diverting 3,000 cubic feet per second, swallows millions of downriver migrating juveniles each year. In drier years, when Shasta Lake swelters for months in 100-degree heat, the warm water emanating into the lower river cooks vast numbers of eggs and juveniles, which usually cannot tolerate water warmer than 60 degrees. An abandoned mine near Shasta leaches ghostly wastes when it rains, and agriculture adds pesticides and herbicides. But the worst hazard to the fishery is the battery of pumps at the south end of the delta, which feed the aqueducts that sustain Southern California. When the State Water Project began operating in the late 60s, joining the Central Valley Project, another couple of million acre-feet of water that used to pour out to sea was sucked across a delta by the pumps, confusing the upriver migrating adults and entraining tens of millions of hapless juveniles, which go wherever the river currents, natural or artificial, want them to go. In wet years, in the 60s and 70s, when the Delta pumps diverted only 20% of the Sacramento outflow, the escapement ratio was high, and millions of young fish made it to sea, where they could fatten in ocean pastures and return in great numbers to spawn. But in drier years, when as much as 50% of the Sacramento River outflow was sucked toward Southern California, escapement was low, salmon mortality was high, and the commercial fleet, still comprised of many hundreds of boats, braced itself for poor seasons in the years immediately to come. As it happened, the 1986 floods coincided perfectly with a heavy out-migration of young fish, so the escapement ratio was better than great. It was fabulous. The offshore catch in 2 or 3 years, when fish of the 1986 class returned to spawn, was going to be the best in decades. I first encountered that prediction a few weeks after the floods in an obscure publication called Fridays, the biweekly house organ of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, which is put out by the PCFFA's only paid staff member, a fish processor's son with a law degree named Zeke Grader. He is one of a handful of people in the world who are paid to think exactly as a salmon would think, which means that his thinking tends to be the opposite of most everyone else's. In the dry months and years following the 1986 floods, Grader's optimism about the 1986 class fish was counterweighted by a deepening pessimism over the fishery's long-term prognosis. His reasoning was simple and not arguable. Salmon have to confront a drought right away. Everyone else, cushioned by years' worth of reservoir storage, does not. It might not be obvious to people, but it was already obvious to the fish. California, in 1987, had entered a year of severe drought, and because droughts tend to come in cycles, there was apt to be another dry year, and then, conceivably, several more. No big floods, surplus flows and water buffalo argot, were going to flush tens of millions of newly hatched salmon and steelhead past the insistent pull of 300,000 horsepower Delta pumps, not to mention the 160-odd diversion intakes, mostly lacking fish screens, between the Delta and Shasta Dam. In July of 1987, Grader observed in Fridays that 85% of the spring flow of the Sacramento River had been either diverted or held in storage that year, with unknown but potentially devastating consequences for the fishery. He quoted Dr. Michael Rosengert, an expatriate Russian fisheries biologist, who compared California's situation to what the Russians had done to the Sea of Azov, a spectacular fishery turned into a biological desert by Stalin's directive to irrigate a limitless acreage of cotton. During the next several years, I know this because I recently read 5 years of Fridays over a weekend, Zeke Rader sounded more and more like John the Baptist, although he must have felt more like Sisyphus. Fridays has only a few thousand readers, most of whom are West Coast fishermen or fisheries biologists, who needed no convincing that the drought could mean disaster for the salmon if extraordinary measures weren't taken to protect them. That is the sometimes fatal weakness of anadromous fish. By insisting on spawning in rivers and estuaries, they are like an army trapped in a mountain cul-de-sac, easy pickings for forces, natural or unnatural, which is to say human, that are far beyond their control. But after years of intense drought, as Grader noted again and again, the Bureau of Reclamation and Department of Water Resources, which essentially run the Sacramento River watershed, were still allocating water as if these were normal times. They had taken nearly all of the salmon habitat. Now they were taking most of the water, and the fish with it. The most significant statistics from the drought, which Zeke Rader, to my knowledge, was the first to elucidate, really had nothing to do with precipitation and everything to do with what happened to the precipitation after it fell. In 1987, which was categorized as a critically dry year, the driest of five classifications, the Central Valley Project and State Water Project gave their agricultural customers, who consume 95% of the CVP supply and around 65% of the SWP's average yield, every acre-foot of their water entitlements, based on the carryover they held in storage. The water managers could have argued, in 1987, that they were blindsided by the suddenness of the drought. But in 1988, another critically dry year, agriculture got full entitlements again. In 1989, a year classified as dry, nearly all CVP and SWP customers received full water deliveries again. It wasn't until 1990, a desolately dry year despite some late rains in May, that the two huge water agencies began cutting back their agricultural customers. But even in that year, a big block of users with water rights predating the Central Valley Project received normal year water supplies. One consequence of this policy, or lack of a policy, was that carryover storage in Shasta Lake dropped so low that in February of 1991, the Bureau predicted that the reservoir, by far the largest in California, would be the world's biggest mudflat by fall of that year, down to 2 or 3% of its capacity of 4,500,000 acre feet. The Bureau was rescued, barely, by another late spell of wet weather in March, but had those storms not come through, there would have been no CVP water for anyone, fish, fowl, humans, or crops, by summer's end. From the fisheries' point of view, though, the most devastating consequence was that most of the runoff that reached the California Delta in those years never reached the bay. It was immediately diverted across the Delta by the project's huge batteries of pumps. In fact, from 1987 through 1989, Delta exports increased every year as river flows and reservoir storage dropped abysmally. In those 3 years, runoff to the Delta averaged 9 or 10 million acre feet, while Delta diversions climbed from 5.2 million acre feet in 1987 to 6.1 million acre feet in 1989, a level barely surpassed in the wettest years. On the other hand, the four runs of salmon, whose young rode out to sea on 20 to 30 million acre feet of runoff before the great projects were built, had had their water supply reduced by almost 90%. Young salmon tend to go where most of the water flows, and most of it was now flowing into the deadly maws of the South Delta pumps. No one could even guess how many tens of millions or hundreds of millions of juvenile salmon perished at the pump's vast graveyard during the first several years of the drought. But the perverse irony was that as the future California salmon fishery was being decimated as never before, the fishermen in 1988 hauled in the biggest harvest since 1945. As Zeke Rader had predicted 2 years earlier, the numbers of returning salmon that year, mostly fall run from the 1986 class that zoomed out to sea on the February flood tide, was greater than all but the oldest commercial fishermen could remember. The offshore catch that year totaled 1,400,000 fish, weighing more than 15 million pounds, a bonanza worth about $150 million. Sport fishermen hauled in hundreds of thousands more, and another couple of 100,000 spawners, about as many as the depleted rivers could handle, swam to upriver reds. As newspapers published photographs of salmon boats listing into port with huge piles of salmon on board, Zeke Rader was devoting whole issues of Fridays to a new antithetical prognosis, that the salmon industry would suffer catastrophically in the years ahead. It's possible his own constituency wasn't listening by then. But he was right. In the 1960s, about 130,000 winter-run salmon returned to the Sacramento River to spawn, the remnants of a run that probably numbered in the half-million range before the state and federal projects were built. By the early 70s, the winter run was down to about 20,000 fish. By 1987, it was down to 2,000. By 1991, the biologists counting the fish may have come close to outnumbering the fish. 191 spawners made it to the Red Bluff diversion dam. The spring run, much harder to count, was probably down to 2,000 survivors, mainly due to depleted rivers, which were partly the fault of the drought, and unnatural delta flows, which were not. By then, the fall hatchery run, which made up most of the huge 1988 catch, had crashed too. In 1992, the Pacific Fisheries Management Council imposed the most stringent quotas in history on the commercial fleet, and they applied to varying degrees, from central California to the Canadian border, because California salmon tend to head north once at sea. The offshore California harvest in 1992 was about 150,000 fish. A lot of boats never bothered to go out. If they had, the whole season would have yielded a few dozen fish per boat, worth less than the fuel required to catch them. but even boats in Washington state were forced to languish at dockside for weeks because farmers in California, 1,200 miles away, were granted normal deliveries of subsidized water during the first several years of the worst drought in that state's history. As it turned out, however, the hand of justice could be as perverse as the kiss of irony. In 1991, and again in 1992, the CVP and the SWP water contractors finally experienced the same sort of water rationing, and worse, that salmon and fishermen had endured since the drought's first week. The State Water Project made no deliveries to agriculture in 1991. None. Most of the Bureau's customers saw their water supply reduced by 75%. In 1992, an election year, they got a little more water through the direct intervention of someone who had received millions of dollars in San Joaquin Valley PAC money, the President of the United States. Many growers shifted from surface water to groundwater, but they paid a price. Groundwater can be several times more expensive. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of acres were taken out of production. Tens of thousands of people, mostly farm workers, lost their jobs. Welfare caseloads rose astronomically, and in some agricultural counties, unemployment rates brushed 30%. Because the reservoirs had been so drastically depleted during the first 4 years of the drought, the Department of Water Resources and the Bureau had no choice but to cut the growers off. In 1991, and again in 1992, the CVP had just over 5 million acre-feet in storage in May, when most runoff has entered the reservoirs, and the growers, irrigating millions of acres, could have used it all up by July. But now there was an entirely new reason why they couldn't let much of the water go. By 1992, the winter-run Chinook was listed as a threatened species by the federal government and as an endangered species by the state of California. The spring-run salmon was not yet listed because, as part of the recovery plan, almost all salmon fishing off California and Oregon might have had to be banned. By the fall of 1992, however, the spring run, now represented by fewer than 1,000 survivors, looked as if it might be listed too. The late fall run Chinook was regarded by fisheries biologists as a species of special concern, which meant that it might have to be listed too. It was not inconceivable, if the drought went on, that almost every salmon in California might eventually join the endangered species list. The San Joaquin Valley growers, of course, were inclined to blame the whole situation on everything and everyone but themselves, if not exclusively on nature's drought, then on high seas drift net fishing, on ocean warming, on overfishing by the West Coast salmon fleet, the most drastically policed fishing fleet in the world, on dredge spoils dumped into San Francisco Bay, on seals and sea lions, on logging in the watersheds, on polluted runoff from abandoned mines, on any cause with a quarter gram of plausibility. All of these horrors resulted in the loss of some fish. All of them combined are less responsible than the combination of empty rivers, intolerably warm rivers, and rivers flowing reverse toward power and wealth. So the fate of California agriculture is now helplessly entwined because of its insatiable thirst for water with the fate of the California salmon fisheries. In October of 1992, Congressman George Miller of California, the new chairman of the House Interior Committee, and Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey saw their Central Valley Project Reform Act blown through the House and Senate and onto the president's desk. Members of Congress from the Northwest voted for the bill in order to protect their own salmon fleets. Members from urban California voted for the bill because their constituents had endured severe water rationing while agriculture had not. Members from nearly every other state voted for the bill because, in their opinion, agribusiness in California has gotten everything it wanted for far too long, often at the expense of farmers in their own states. Among other things, the Miller-Bradley legislation takes 800,000 acre-feet of water from agriculture and dedicates it to wetlands and fisheries, the first such reallocation since the Central Valley Project Act was passed in 1933. The only question is whether it isn't already too late. In the fall of 1992, more than 300 of the 350-odd salmon boats that comprised the fleet at Fort Bragg, California, were for sale. And winter-run salmon from the class of 1991, tatters of evolution, were being reared for tanks at San Francisco's Steinhardt Aquarium, like the condors at the San Diego Zoo. You can replant an orchard and have it back in 10 years, Zeke Rader told me one morning in the summer of 1992. You lose a salmon that took 20,000 years to evolve, and you never get it back. The fishermen know that closing the season is their only choice. They know it's their only